It was kind of obvious right away. Like as soon as I started thinking about that, I was thinking, well, maybe I can get back into music. You know, maybe there's still a way that I can pursue that dream, which had been like such a big part of my dream and my goal and my vision as I was growing up. And it was something that I was so focused on for, you know, those 10 years of my life. When I started discovering composing and creating a home studio and like working, like getting commissioned to write for various organizations and the kind of work that has flexibility where, you know, I can now drop the kids off at school and then come home and work on my projects and then put the kids to bed and then work on my projects some more in the evening. And I have that flexibility, and I'm doing music. That's something that I had never seen as an eventuality of something that I could ever be qualified for when I was younger. So that's why I didn't pursue it. But then discovering that it's not only something that I actually love even more than performing. I love this the studio environment and I love composing, but it's also something that has a work-life balance that is actually a lot better than the office job that I worked at before.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This week's episode is with the Canadian musician Jack Hoy Litster, who has developed a satisfying creative career after some interesting twists and turns. In this episode, you'll learn about his experiences as a jazz drummer, his pivot into international development, and his path back to composing, producing, and recording music in different styles. The music included in this episode features two tracks from his album Shining Suns, a Guzheng improvisation, and an excerpt from his second opera, What Is Love? We talked about different ways to make a living as a musician, achieving a flow state, some of the positive impacts of technology, and the importance of finding a work-life balance. Like all my episodes, this is available wherever you listen to podcasts, also as a video on YouTube, and the transcript with the show notes are all linked on my website, leahroseman.com. Please consider buying me a coffee. I'm an independent podcaster and I need my listeners' help. The link for my support page is in the show notes. I've also included detailed timestamps if you want to jump to any topic or musical selection. Hi, Jack. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Great to be here. Thanks for this opportunity, Leah. Great to talk to you.
And a fellow Ottawa musician, it's nice we're in the same time zone. Sometimes I have to do these at such odd hours, so this is great. It's like a good time of day for me.
Yeah, it's a nice warm day here in Ottawa for sure.
You do so many things, and I thought it would be really interesting to talk about your background in terms of how you got to where you are today. And I like to share music towards the beginning of an episode because it's just, you know, it's a podcast about music, so it's a wonderful way to bring people in. So right. If we could talk a little bit about the album you released a few months ago, Shining Suns, and there's one electronic music track on it, Awakener, that I really love that would be nice to share.
Yeah, so the album itself is, I thought of it as my first solo album that I've released on the various streaming platforms. And I started conceptualizing it as a solo album. It didn't end up being solo in any way. I have a number of different artists that are joining me on various melody instruments. Primarily, it's seven songs. And the seven songs of Shining Suns, it sounds like a title of a saga, so the seven songs of Shining Suns. It charts a journey, and it's a personal story. It's a kind of an autobiographical seven songs, and they're all instrumental. There's no words. It's not a spoken story, but it's this journey that I went through in my 30s of, you know, being in a stable place, but realizing that I'm not where I want to be in terms of not having music as my primary way I'm spending my days. I had worked in various nonprofit organizations in the human rights realm for about 10 years. And it was at a time in my life where I was starting to transition back to music, but I had started out as a musician and now it was coming back to music. And it was this difficult transition to leave the steady the steady paycheck, right, and then to move back to the uncertainties of music, but knowing that there's such rich opportunities and so many unknown possibilities that are calling you. So that album is really about following that calling. And so it starts off, the first track is called Before, And it paints a picture of, you know, things are very peaceful and serene and everything's fine, but you can hear in the I use some sound designs, some various field recordings of a campfire and footsteps on a beach and then waves, and you can sort of hear footsteps in the sand walking out towards the water, and that's sort of the calling. And then the next several tracks are I envision you sort of take the plunge and you get in a boat or you start swimming out to sea, but it's unknown out there. And then the next several tracks, so this is the album here. So then the next several tracks, Fierce Light, which features Raphael Weinroth Brown on cello, phenomenal. The first track features Emily Kalanka Gong on flute. So Fierce Light, Awakener, which is the one that you talked about, Path of Best Resistance and Streets of Orange are those turbulent phases in the journey, and they're in different styles of music as well. Fierce Light is more cinematic chamber music, and then Awakener is more like electronic and percussion ensemble with some synths, and then Path of Best Resistance and Streets of Orange are quite electronic in the dance and drum and bass realms. And then there's this sort of arrival at the other shore, and the tension just releases. The first of the last two pieces, All Possibilities, is just singing, so just layers and layers of vocals, and just this, it's kind of feels like you've gone into the spa or something. And then the last piece is this really joyful and triumphant jazz big band style piece that Peter Kankura and Mark Ferguson joined me on, and that my kids join me on as well. So that's sort of that journey of trying to get to where you think you're supposed to be, and all the challenges or struggles that you might face internally along the way. And then, but you know that there's a beautiful shining shore on the other side that you can reach, and that in my life personally I have reached, but I wanted to, you know, sort of try to tell that story musically. So that's the Shining Sun story, the saga.
Yeah, congratulations. You know, I've listened to it, of course, on Bandcamp, but I didn't realize you had vinyl. That's so, it, like, more and more people are making vinyl available.
Just the one, actually. So this is
Oh,
a
okay.
birthday present. This is a birthday present that I got last week from my wife, and she had it like a single pressing done. There's
Aw,
a
that's so
custom
nice.
place, 'cause yeah, I'm primarily a studio musician. I'm not touring or
Yeah.
performing this record, so I'm not going to be out selling copies of the vinyl. It'd be great to have a stack of it, but for now, anyway, what's good?
It's great to know you could do that, though.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was very surprised. You know, because it always needs to be big quantities with these things, right? Because that's how they make it work. But it is possible to do a single pressing.
I will talk to your wife about that. That's very cool. Yeah. So let's talk. Well, I think now we'll play this track, Awakener.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for that. So the percussion, you started as a jazz drummer. Maybe it'd be interesting to talk about that and your teen years and what you were doing.
Sure. Yeah, I was thinking about that yesterday, thinking we're going to talk about this today, because it's interesting. I was in some ways kind of a hesitant jazz drummer, kind of reluctantly ended up playing jazz, because even though jazz drumming is very central to the way I approach the drums, but the way I approach music more broadly, just the rhythmic freedom that comes with understanding jazz drumming is very much very central to the way I create music. And so I'm that'll always be an important part of me. But I felt growing up that jazz was, there's something that's not as accessible as I would like about jazz. And, you know, I didn't grow up in the golden age of jazz. I didn't grow up in the 1960s or 50s and or 70s when all of these ideas were first being created and were new and were fresh. I grew up in an age where, you know, I was playing jazz in trios in restaurants and at private events and stuff like that. And it was sort of a trying to capture a sound that had been heard a few generations back, and so trying to do our best to recreate a certain type of sound. And it's commercially being used as background music, right? Like I played in lots of restaurants. I grew up in small town Ontario, and you know, the higher cost restaurants would hire young jazz musicians to come and play, and so we were the background music. We were the sort of the wallpaper for the fine dining, and it was fun. I enjoyed it, but it didn't feel as much of a connection with the audience. And that's really what I wanted. But I knew I wanted to study music in university. And as someone whose primary instrument is drums and percussion, I had mostly the two paths, right? The classical percussion or jazz drumming. And I wasn't as drawn to classical percussion. I've studied bits and pieces of it, and I'm much more into orchestral music now than I was then. But at the time, it wasn't calling to me, and I thought jazz would be more interesting. So I studied jazz. I did a diploma in music performance at St. Francis Xavier University. So that's how I ended up doing more and more jazz. But yeah, I started out playing jazz drums. But I also was involved in other interesting aspects of percussion. Like when I was in high school, I was invited to be the director of a percussion ensemble that had never existed in my high school before. They kind of created it so that I could lead it. And I, you know, it was a large high school. We had about 2,000 students, and I knew the community really well. So I knew who the other folks were who played drums, who might be interested in joining this percussion ensemble. So we put together this percussion ensemble. We co-wrote some music. I wrote some pieces for it, and we played, like we played in a float at the Santa Claus parade. We played at various elementary schools around the town. We played at the high school concerts. So that was really interesting too. And then I played a fair amount of Broadway musical type shows in my local town, and also at various schools. And then played in other styles, played in church, you know. So I got exposed to lots of different styles of music on drums, and I loved that.
Mm-hmm. So St. FX is one of the jazz programs in Canada people hear about. What was your experience like over there?
I mean, it was great. I had some, I was at a, there at a time with some amazing students. I had like a lot of really great friends who were really inspiring musicians in all kinds of genres, like folks who were really into jazz and were really great at it and were really pursuing that. And so I got to play with folks like that, and then folks who were pursuing like singer-songwriter type stuff on the side, several great singers, and then folks who were experimenting with other stuff like funk music. So I was in a number of different bands there. I thought that was really great. And the teachers were for the most part quite strong as well too. I was there at a time when Dave Restivo was there. He's a phenomenal jazz pianist. He played in Rob McConnell's Boss Brass for years. He's living out in the West Coast. He's teaching in, I think, Selkirk College in Nelson now. But he was there for just 2 years, and they happened to be the same 2 years I was there, and I got to study piano privately with him as well, and that was quite eye-opening. He's phenomenal. And Tom Daniels was the guitar prof there. There were a lot of great folks there. I also got really into the vibraphone while I was there. I played vibraphone in some of the ensembles as well, and wrote some music that was performed by a few different ensembles. So I was starting to get into composing then a little bit on the side as well. But yeah, on the whole, it was a great experience. I really loved my time in Anakin-ish, little small town. So, you know, it was about 150 music students in a town of about 10,000 people. Yeah. So we were pretty, it was pretty saturated with music, which was really nice. Yeah.
And you play guitar and keyboard as well.
Yeah. You know, funny story about that. So piano is my first instrument. So I started playing piano when I was 7, never really liked it at that time, because I thought, well, piano's not cool. Piano is not an instrument you could play in a band. Like, this was what I was telling myself, because it was the 90s and you didn't see many piano players in the rock band. So I was like, well, piano's not cool. I don't want to play piano. And that was part of the reason why young Jack moved to drums. But then when I finished my studies at St. Francis Xavier University, when I first moved to Ottawa, my wife and I, we weren't married yet, but we were living in a small apartment, and the kind of apartment where you can't really set up a drum set and play and have your neighbors still like you. So we had a guitar, and I had to play music. And so I just started teaching myself guitar and playing more and more guitar, just because I had to have an outlet, and my drums were just in their cases. So that's how I got into playing guitar as well.
Okay, that's an interesting story. I was talking to a young trumpet player recently, and he was saying, oh yeah, and his partner's a horn player. And I asked, what's that like trying to find an apartment? And he said, well, the last time we went looking for apartments, I brought my trumpet with me. I said, I play this. And they said, is it loud? He said, it's really loud. And he showed them how loud. But they managed to find an apartment that was like a back house. This is in LA, so they could sort of be separate.
Yeah. No, that's smart. That's smart. Be upfront about it. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to move in and then they tell you you can't play.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
So I was just thinking, you know, about jazz gigs, and unfortunately it's so hard. Like Ottawa, we're a relatively small city of about 1 million people, but an incredibly vibrant jazz scene in terms of the number of great jazz musicians. I don't think there's enough places for people to play, and not enough places, you know, I'd like to see more real concert settings.
Yeah.
So in the last week, I went to one of the small clubs where people play, and, you know, it was a handful of people. Some people were paying attention. It was disappointing, you know, for my colleagues on stage. And then I heard another one that was actually a concert setting, and they were saying what a difference it was for them to have that respect. Yeah. And I would love to see more jazz concerts in proper theaters and treated more like the classical side.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting. You know, jazz has its kind of ebbs and flows of popularity. I wasn't at the concert, but I heard about the concert that Leve did during the Jazz Fest here. And so she's a young Icelandic singer that sings very much in the style of classic jazz of the 40s and 50s. And it was sold out. And I think she did two shows, and she's singing fairly straight ahead jazz, and she's got a huge crowd of young folks younger than me, which is so cool. You know, things can just come around, and people rediscover styles of music that they might not have heard, or maybe that has echoes of films that they love, or that music that their parents or grandparents listen to, and it connects them and strikes a chord. And so yeah, jazz has some really cool potential for sure.
Now, you mentioned your wife, she's from Hong Kong.
Yes.
Chinese background. So yeah. Can we talk about the Guzheng and what that whole adventure was about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I recently did a Master of Arts in Music and Culture here at Carleton, and one of the things that you can do as part of that degree, it's a fantastic program, by the way. I must say I love it. It's very, very open-minded, as is their undergraduate program. So I was work in that degree, I was working my way towards my thesis, which was an analysis of Tan Doon's score for the film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And I knew that in my second year, I would be spending a lot of time watching and listening and analyzing and reading about that score and that film. And I felt that if I just walked into that, out of my first year in the program, I really wouldn't be prepared to be able to comment on the Chinese music in that film, because the unique thing for me about that film, which the more I analyzed it, I realized it's actually been done in lots of different ways over the past 150 years. But it was a breakout success, that film. And the thing that stood out for me is how that film really seamlessly blended European orchestral traditions with Chinese traditional instruments and Chinese orchestra. And so I thought, well, okay, I've studied orchestration, I've worked a bit in that world, but how much do I really know about Chinese music to be able to really have something to say? So it was possible during that degree to take a directed study in performance as one of the courses for that in my first year. And usually when folks do that, they have a teacher in mind that they're going to work one-on-one with on their primary instrument to get deeper on a certain technique or a certain set of repertoire or something like that. But they let me do it on an instrument that I had never played before. So I did a directed study for 8 months studying Guzheng with Zishan Yang, who's a great Guzheng virtuoso and teacher here in Ottawa, and who had connections with Carleton in the past. And so I studied the Guzheng for 8 months. And for me, that was really a nice way to be able to spend time connecting more with the culture of my wife's side of the family, and also of my children's culture as well too, because I've tried to study Cantonese several times now and made some progress. But it's the kind of thing where with any language, you need immersion and you need consistency over months and over years. And I haven't been able to get as deep as I would like in that. So I thought, well, as a musician, if there's a way that I can spend time focusing on learning Chinese culture through the music, that would be amazing for me. So that was something that I got to do. And so I learned, a decent amount of some of the beginner repertoire for Guzheng, and then gave a lecture recital as well. And I wrote a couple pieces that were performed at that as well. And my daughter was studying Guzheng for a few years as well, and so she also performed the she, her and I did the final piece together as a duet. So that was really special too.
Yeah, that's really wonderful.
Yeah.
I was in China once, actually, when we adopted our younger daughter, who's born in
Okay.
China.
Okay.
And I remember there was some dinner that our guides had organized. We all have these
Yeah.
toddlers we just adopted, we're exhausted. But there was this Guzheng player who was just phenomenal. And I remember just standing there with the kids and just watched, listening to her. And but it was in a restaurant setting, right? It's like always the thing, but it was great. So you prepared a really fun improv using live looping to share with this episode.
I did. I recorded that on Monday. Yeah, very much inspired by my friend Raphael Weinroth Brown, and I've been following his career and getting to work with him a little bit. He's a phenomenal cellist, internationally renowned, based here in Ottawa, as previous guest on this podcast. And he does the kind of thing that I did with some editing after the words. He does that live and in, very beautiful and cinematic and virtuosic ways. And so I've been wanting to explore that with the Guzheng, of having a part that begins, and not all the parts are standard Guzheng technique. I'm tapping on the sides of the instrument to get percussive sounds. I'm strumming it in the way that you would strum a guitar. I'm bowing it, which is a bit unusual. But then having these various layers that build on each other in sequence to develop into a larger idea, as if I'm cloning myself and having multiple versions of myself. But yeah, so that was kind of fun.
I know a lot of musicians got into looping during the pandemic when they couldn't play with other people. Was that the case for you?
Well, it's actually something that I haven't really pursued in terms of traditional looping, which is you've got the pedal and you're being able to hear all those layers live in real time. So when I recorded that multi-track Guzheng piece a few days ago, I could only hear the things that I was playing live, and it all went into my software. I use Ableton Live. And then I had one, 4-minute track, but then I took pieces of it and turned them into loops. And some of them were continuous loops. Some of them came in at times and then came out when I hit the cymbal at the very beginning. That's something that I use as a transition piece. And it's also heard reversed as well. I did about 4 takes for that and then liked the last one. So it's about half an hour of recording and then about an hour of editing to get that piece. But as I was doing it, I wasn't hearing the other layers. I would need to get like a contact mic on the Guzheng itself and have a pedal. And so I'm a few steps away from actually being able to do any of that kind of stuff live. It's something that I would love to explore more, but that type of thing is what got me into composing a few years ago, actually. So when I first discovered recording software, which is amazingly accessible now, accessible in terms of if you have the means to access something like an iPhone or any type of Apple device, which I'm not saying that everyone has access to one of those, but they are fairly accessible. And then there's free software such as GarageBand, which you can just use on your phone to create multi-tracked. You can create orchestral music using free software on your phone. And that's how I first got into multi-tracking. And then that led to discovering my love for composing as a primary musical outlet. And then, that led to other things.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of listening, you had told me that you really love Renaissance choral music.
Right. And it's funny, I think when we were talking about this before, I think I mentioned that I didn't know years ago when I was young that was the particular genre that I was so drawn to. And I didn't know because I grew up, one of my favorite styles of music growing up was choral Christmas music. And choral Christmas music of the type that you would hear sung by professional choirs in England, like the King's College Choir, those types of recordings, or the King's Singers. And so I just loved the way the voices would blend, the way those compositions would flow, the way the harmonies worked, just everything about it. It really resonated with me. And part of that is, my dad and his 4 younger brothers all went to St. Mike's Choir School in Toronto. So I was kind of always around choirs. I was always around choral singing. I sang in some choirs when I was in high school, and so it was kind of always in the blood. But whenever Christmas would come around, I would start the season early. It would be like September, and I'd be getting out the King's College Choir and just listening to those beautiful harmonies. And it was only, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago that I started discovering Thomas Tallis, and I started discovering Palestrina, and I just started discovering all these fantastic Renaissance composers, and realizing like, oh, there's it's not just the Christmas music. There's a whole several hundred years of this style of writing, and it's still performed and recorded by so many great singing groups. And so that's, I really fell in love with that style of music, and it still is really close to my heart. So I'm very happy to have the opportunity to be writing some choral music now professionally as well.
Yeah, so you've written 2 operas.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, did you write the librettos as well?
For the first one, I did. For the first one, which is called The Day You Were Born, I wrote that libretto. I had some help from Jessica Ruano, who's a local playwright and producer. She created the Gomeshi Effect several years ago, a very successful play that she toured. So, and she had just adopted her daughter at that time, and so she was closely connected to the subject matter of that opera as well. So she was just kind of a sounding board and gave feedback and sort of questioned a lot of ideas as I was writing the libretto. So that was really instrumental and helpful for me. And then the second opera that I wrote was, the text is all from a classic book of poetry by Khalil Gibran called The Prophet. And so we took the first chapter, which is called On Love, and pretty much adapted almost word for word that whole chapter into my second opera, What is Love?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, just before we go on to that, because I know we're going to be playing the finale from that opera.
Yeah.
The first one about, like, I know you had interviewed midwives, like you really went deep.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So I first met Norm Brown, who runs Opera Ottawa, and we'd worked together. I'd played percussion on one of the operas that they had performed. This was pre-COVID. And then he invited me, you know, would you like to write for our company? Something small, maybe like a one-act opera, was what we started talking about. And as soon as we got there in the conversation, I thought, okay, like if I'm creating an opera, you know, opera stories are you know, known for being very emotional, right? Like the drama is rich and full, and they're not pulling any punches. It's intense tragedy and intense death and intense love and intense betrayal, and all this kind of stuff is sort of very classic to the way opera singing works. Like opera singing is very powerful because it's portraying these very intense emotions. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to write an opera, I want to draw on some kind of lived experience. I don't want to pretend to be, you know, some epic character that I have no actual lived experience with. So the most intense experience that I'd experienced at that point was seeing the birth of my two children. And it's such a, you know, it's so fundamental to life itself. It's something that everyone can relate to because everyone's either been born or given birth or seen a birth or all three, right? So I thought, well, maybe I can find a way to write an opera that explores all the emotions that lead up to that, and then are that moment, and then act two of the opera explores some other aspects of parenting and stuff. But I thought, you know, I have my experience being in the room as my wife gave birth to our two kids, and I was able to deliver my son Fenton when he came out. So I have a little piece of the experience as an observer. But if I really want to tell this story, I need more than just what I've experienced and seen. So I talked to a number of mothers about their birthing stories and their birth experiences, a number of midwives as well too. And the main character of that opera that I wrote, The Day You Were Born, is, her name's Isla, and she's a midwife as well too. So so that factors into the story too, but I wanted to do justice to that, because I really, the three midwives that were there when my son Fenton was born were just, they were like family to us. Like they, you know, they weren't family, but they were just, the way they supported us through that was just so, so meaningful. And I, you know, I wanted to honor them, mm-hmm. in a way. And so I was really happy to have the opportunity to do that as best as I could.
Yeah, I remember when I was pregnant with our first child, one of my colleagues said, "Do you have a midwife?" And I didn't, wasn't even aware. I think it was recent in Ontario that was even part of the medical system.
Right.
And I said, "Is that even a thing?" She said, "It's, look, you're not ill. You don't need a doctor. You need a midwife. You should get on the list right away." And I'm so glad she talked to me about that, because it completely transformed the whole experience.
Amazing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Same. Yeah.
So, this first opera that we were just talking about was recorded during lockdown. Can you explain how that worked?
It was. So that was a project that we'd started talking about in late fall 2019, around December 2019. We started talking about it. And then I think I started writing or conceptualizing in the couple months before the first lockdown started. So in January, February 2020. And then we were working on, you know, making plans for how we're going to record a crowdfunding video to start, you know, getting some support for this project. And then the lockdown happened. And so we really hadn't got very far at all. And so the first lockdown in Ontario in March 2020, they shut all the schools and didn't open them for 6 months. And so we had our kids here at home. And it was, you know, as everyone remembers, it was pretty restricted at that point. Folks were mostly staying at home. You weren't really associating with anyone else in person. There were a lot of new bylaws about how and why you couldn't interact in person at all. And so I wrote the opera over the next 12 months or so, and then come spring 2021, and I can't really remember where the pandemic was at. It sort of had its ebbs and flows and its different waves, but we had hopes that, you know, we've been in this pandemic for so long, maybe it will wrap up and live performance will start to bounce back, and maybe the timing will work out that as soon as we're ready to actually get together and perform it, maybe we'll have to still wear masks, but maybe an audience will still be there. But then there was another one of those spring waves, and everything shut down completely again in spring 2021. So the singers already had all their parts. They had already been working on everything. And the way we did that, it was really like, you know, you look back on some of the things that we accomplished individually and as a community in COVID, and you just shake your head. Like, it's so, you know, this was my first opera. Like, I was not a seasoned veteran of opera by any stretch of the imagination. So I'd written this 40 minutes of music, and Fred Lacroix, a phenomenal pianist here in Ottawa, just everybody loves him, and he's just ridiculously talented. He's just a phenomenal force of nature at the piano. So he was the accompanist for this performance, and he recorded the piano reduction for every single piece and on video from his home during lockdown, and then sent all those videos to all the singers for all their different arias, and for all the, there was two choral pieces as well with over a dozen singers, and everyone then recorded like with Fred's piano in their earbuds, well, not headphones, yeah, and mostly earbuds, so it would look more like we were actually, you know, not in a studio. And they recorded all their parts from home, and then they sent them, transferred the files to me, and then I edited it all together. I did all the mixing, and then I did all the video editing of the classic sort of Zoom style gallery view of all the heads next to each other, and we ended up doing the whole opera that way, and then releasing it to the world on YouTube in July of 2021. And yeah, looking back on it, it seems like it's just an unbelievable story to tell. But I mean, we didn't have live performances, so that was kind of, that was the, you know, you were there, you went through all that, Leah. Like, that was kind of, those kinds of things were sort of the best we had at the time. So we did kind of lean into them and get the most out of it, as crazy as they were, you know.
Well, it was spring of 2021 that I started this podcast, actually.
Oh, okay.
Because there were no Amazing. Performances and
yeah.
people had time to talk to me.
Yeah.
Now I have to schedule like 8 months ahead often, or, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it's very emotional to see that video. People can check it out on YouTube because,
right.
you know, remembering and seeing everyone isolated. And yeah. I can't imagine the work you put into editing that.
It was big. Yeah, it was big. But it was, you know, it's the kind of thing where, like, as a composer, you know, I play a number of different instruments, and I can sit down and create music myself. But when you're composing, you're writing music and you're writing it in notation and you have it in your head. Sometimes you'll sing it through and get a sense of, okay, here's how the words are going to fit. Here's how it's going to sound together. But you're mostly like folks that use computer notation software like Sibelius, which I use. You're hearing like a really bad rendering of it playing back. You're like, okay, the harmonies are okay. Like, okay, that works. But it's a very rough version of it. But then you have real great musicians perform it, and they send that back to you. It's like getting the most amazing Christmas present you've ever gotten. And I was receiving so many of those over a number of weeks, and just hearing these beautiful performances of these pieces that had only ever lived in my head before, and seeing them brought to life. It was emotional. It was really special. I was, yeah, it was a highlight of, you know, those difficult days of the lockdowns for me, for sure. Yeah.
So then this second opera, it was still performed in masks, though, like to see these singers.
Yeah, it was, you know what? Yeah, I feel like the pandemic was still kind of lingering into early 2022, right? And there'd been a few false starts with live music, right? Like I think the summer before had been a little better at times, and we'd tried to do some, you know, distanced outdoor performances or masks. There, you know, everybody spread out inside, all those kinds of things. So we'd tried it, but it hadn't really worked. And then, so we performed What Is Love, my second opera, in person in June 2022, so just over a year ago now. And it was the beginning, or the first few weeks or months into like a really big resurgence summer, right? Like last summer there was, I remember going to live music like many times a week and just getting exhausted because all the festivals were back. They'd been gone for, I don't know if it was 2 or 3 years, but everything had been gone, and then everything was alive again. And it was so we performed What Is Love in the sort of beginning of that sort of rebirth of all the live performance here in Ottawa. And it was just really, really spectacular to have everybody in person. We had about 100 people in the audience for that, which, you know, having that many people in person still felt surreal at that time, you know, like it was, but it was far enough from, like, a lot of people had been vaccinated and all that kind of thing. So we felt like it didn't feel like, oh, there's 100 people inside, this is really sketchy, I want to leave because I'm uncomfortable. It was more like, okay, this is reminding me of what life used to be like, and in a good way, you know. So it was, yeah, it was nice. The timing worked out really well, I think.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need my listeners' help. Please consider buying me a coffee. The link to my Ko-fi page is in the description. Every dollar helps me cover the costs of this huge project. Thanks so much.
So we're going to play this finale now. Do you want to just speak a little bit to what's been, you know, the resolution, the end of this opera in terms of the...
Sure, yeah. So What Is Love? It's told as though there's some young members of a community that walk into the community and say to the members of the community, you know, tell us what's love all about? You know, so we had two fantastic young teenage singers that came and sang the prologue and started things off. And then there's four soloists, so two young man and a young woman, and then a more mature man and woman, and there's a number of duets and solo arias. And so there's just been these reflections on all the different sides that love can have. You know, love encompasses duty, and it encompasses, you know, jealousy, it encompasses devotion, it encompasses romance, there's all these sides to how we experience love. So a lot of the pieces in the opera have those varied emotions, which is one of the things that was really fun about writing it. And then we wrap it all up at the end. It's the one piece where everybody's singing, but they're not always all singing at the same time. There's sort of a fugal part in the middle where each of the soloists are coming in and building on what the previous line has been, and it builds to this sort of happy climax. So yeah, that's sort of what the finale does.
Thanks so much for sharing that. Now, another bit of education you did Berklee Online. You were able to take their film scoring and music business courses?
Yeah. So I've taken 5 courses through Berklee Online over the past 12 years or so. Okay. So I took 2 music business courses in 2011, and then I came back to Berklee Online in, I think it would have been about 2018, 2019, I took a film scoring course, their Film Scoring 101, an orchestration course, and then an electronic music course. And, you know, Berklee has been part of my sort of musical education destination vision since I was a kid. I would see the ads for Berklee College of Music when I was reading Modern Drummer magazine growing up, and I would cut out their ads. They had these ads that said, "Take music, period. Seriously, period," and then their little logo at the bottom. It was very clever. So I cut out those ads and photocopied them and put them up around like the room where I would practice, and put them on my bedroom door. I printed out, and this was the early days of the internet, so websites were like a new thing when I was in high school. I printed out the audition requirements for drum set performance, and I taped them to the door of my bedroom so that I would see them every night as I was about to go to bed, and I would see them every morning as I was getting up. And and I really drove towards that audition, and then literally drove down and did the audition in Boston when I was 18, and got a partial scholarship. But it was still like the Canadian dollar was rock bottom at the time. And so it would have been, you know, more than several degrees in Canada just to try to get through one year. So it just wasn't in the cards to go down there. But I always really admired the breadth of their school. Like, yes, it's a very big program, and they're financially very successful, so they can offer all these different things, and there's a lot of strengths to that. But I found that there weren't too many. I don't know if that's changed in the last couple of decades since I did my undergraduate here in Canada, but I didn't see that in as many of the music education programs in universities here. I just really liked the diversity of different styles of music. It was mostly the different styles of music that they were open to at Berklee, so that always drew me in. But then, yeah, seeing that they have this amazing online school that has, again, dozens and dozens of courses, and they're not cheap, but they're also not as expensive as living in Boston. So they are, you know, you can save up or take out a loan and take some of those courses and get access to really phenomenal teachers. And they keep the class sizes small. It's like 20 students cap, I think, usually for those online courses. And there's like online video calls with the professors every week, and it's mostly asynchronous. You work your way through it, but there's several assignments every week. Like, it's pretty heavy because they're just condensed 3-month semesters. They do 4 3-month semesters a year. So I've learned a lot in the courses that I've taken there. It's quite rich in content, I would say.
That's really good to know.
Yeah.
Now, if we could go back to Shining Suns, the title track is at the end.
Yeah. Right.
And it features great trombone playing by Mark Ferguson, who was a previous guest of the series. But in my episode with him, he played piano only. So people might be curious to hear that, even for that reason.
Yeah.
And there's some special appearances as well on that track.
Yeah. So I had a ton of fun with that. So I was actually, I've worked with Mark off and on over the years. We've performed and recorded together years ago. And then while I was at Carleton, I was his teaching assistant for his jazz harmony course. But then I just admire the guy so much that I then took private lessons with him for part of last year, actually, just to study specifically jazz harmony and, you know, jazz arranging for big band, because he's just so good at that. And he has such deep knowledge from many sides of how that works. He's just, you know, in high demand as an arranger. So I really wanted to learn more about that, because it's something that I love, and it's been part of my musical vocabulary, but I don't have the depth that he has. So I really wanted to learn from him. So that was, I wrote that piece specifically so I could do that kind of thing, where I could hire live players. So Mark on that piece. So that piece, Shining Suns, it's arranged for a 10-piece jazz ensemble. So it's arranged for, let's see, soprano sax, tenor sax, clarinet, and then French horn, trombone, and bass trombone. So Mark recorded the trombone and bass trombone parts, and then Peter Kankura, fantastic sax player and runs the Ottawa Jazz Festival. Lovely, lovely guy. He performed the soprano sax, which is the melody line, and he recorded the clarinet and the tenor sax. So there's a tenor sax solo featured in that song as well. So that was, yeah, it was kind of trying to emulate some of the interesting orchestrational choices of folks like Gil Evans, who would take instruments that you wouldn't always find in a jazz context, like the bassoon, like the French horn, like the tuba, and then put them into big bands just to get different tone colors, different timbres. Yeah, so that's what I was going for mm-hmm. with this one.
And then at the very end.
Yeah, and then at the very end. So this is so Shining Suns, there's a secret song or a hidden track. And I grew up in the 90s, and lots of rock bands back then were putting hidden tracks, like you'd get to the end of the song and then there'd be silence and you figure, oh, I guess the CD's done. But before you get a chance to go and, you know, take it out, another song starts playing. And so we were at some point while I was midway through working on this album, my wife and my kids and I were in the car and we were listening to an album that had a hidden track on it. And so that track came on, and then we were explaining to the kids what a hidden track was, and they said, oh, that's really cool. Daddy, are you going to put a hidden track on your album? And I thought, well, you know, I sort of have the album already all planned and I don't have another track sort of up my sleeve to put on it. And we're, you know, I'm halfway through recording it. But I was like, well, if you guys want to help me write one, then we'll put one on. And so they said yes. And so the hidden track on Shining Suns, my daughter wrote the melody and performed it. So that's her playing guzheng. And then my son is playing the percussion, and the percussion that Fenton plays on it is shaking cereal boxes and playing with bells and things like that. And then I added some piano and some vibraphone and some panda drum. And yeah, and it's my favorite song on the album. And several other people have said that too. They're like, oh, that one at the end, that's really great. I was like, yeah, my daughter wrote that one.
Wonderful. So we'll share that now, but after people hear it, there's more conversation to come. So thanks for sharing that. Started this talk about Shining Suns and your personal journey, and you kind of glossed over these 10 years you spent working in international development. So I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So I, you know, before I pivoted out of music, so I mentioned how I studied jazz at St. Francis Xavier University. And then after I finished my second year, I went and I had a job working in a show band on a cruise ship in the Caribbean. So I did that, and that's where my wife and I met. And as I finished that, I sort of started to think, you know, I don't know if performing music as my primary job is what I want to do. And I realized that because I was sort of, in a way, by working on a cruise ship, I was a little bit put off by the whole, and cruise ships are, don't get me wrong, cruise ships are great in that they're steady jobs. Like, I was performing 6 nights a week, which is hard to come by. Like, there's not a lot of places where you can work 6 nights a week as a musician. So I did love that, but I felt like, you know, I'm performing sort of the same material over and over again for a new crowd every cruise, of folks who are just here to have a good time and, you know, have some drinks. And for me, I didn't see the value in that at the time. And I see the value in that a lot more now. But at the time, I felt like that's not enough. Like, I need to make more of a contribution. Like, growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, and as people were talking more about poverty and climate change and inequality, I just felt like I need to do more than just, you know, help folks have a nice night out at the show. Like, I need to do more than that. So that was what drove me to then go back to university. And when I finished my degree, I went back to school at University of Ottawa, and I did a social sciences degree focused on international development with the goal of working in nonprofit organizations. And I was able to get work fairly soon after I graduated, working part-time and then eventually full-time and then eventually as a manager of various nonprofit organizations. And It was amazing. It was really great decade of my life. I was involved with the Canadian Council for International Cooperation, worked on some of their Asia policy and, you know, did their website, stuff like that. I worked on their Code of Ethics program. And then I shifted into fundraising, and I was doing fundraising and public engagement at Interparis, which is a non-governmental organization, a nonprofit here in Ottawa that works with grassroots local activist organizations in about 20 countries around the world. And that was an amazing job. I felt I got that job when I was 28 and felt like, wow, I've landed in my dream job. This is amazing. Then I want to stay here for the rest of my career, is how I felt coming into that. And then, you know, that type of work, I think, can be really emotionally draining in ways that you don't always name. Like, I think there's unfortunately in the nonprofit sector, there can be this this hero mentality or martyr syndrome. And I don't mean that in a negative way to the folks who are living that, but that's part of the culture. That's sort of built into the culture of working in nonprofits, of that I'm gonna put in these extra hours, and I'm gonna, you know, be available at all hours of the day, and I'm gonna, you know, do these things that are very psychologically intense, and then do them again, and then like that cycle never really stops. Like working on issues like human rights, it doesn't really have a down season, right? Like it's a constant struggle. And so there's a lot of folks that do that for their whole career, and I have so much admiration for them, but I realized that I couldn't do that. I couldn't put in year after year and still have my mental health in a good place. So about 5 or 6 years into that role at Interparis, I thought, you know, I really need to find a way to get back to a good place that will be good for my happiness, like where I will do well. And it was kind of obvious right away. Like as soon as I started thinking about that, I was thinking, well, maybe I can get back into music. You know, maybe there's still a way that I can pursue that dream, which had been like such a big part of my dream and my goal and my vision as I was growing up. And it was something that I was so focused on for, you know, those 10 years of my life and up to when I went and studied at St. FX and then worked on the cruise ship. And I thought, well, maybe I can get back to where I was then. I'd always continued to play music. I'd been involved in different bands, performing in, you know, various styles of music, and had done some recording. But I finally started to realize, you know, maybe I can be involved in things like producing and things like composing, things that you can do from home, which are so key when you're a father of young kids, right? Like that was the other thing about performance that really made me uneasy, was, you know, being in my early 20s and just having met the love of my life, and thinking, like, imagining starting a family and thinking, well, if the way I can have full-time work as a performing drummer in the styles of music that I'm qualified to play are going to involve things like working on a cruise ship, or things like touring, or things like having to move to a big city and trying to make it in places where there is enough work, then that's going to mean I'm working weekends and evenings like pretty consistently. And what kind of a home life is that going to lead to? And, you know, maybe it could have been great. There's a lot of people that thrive in that and have great families. I'm not saying it can't be done. I just didn't know if I wanted to try and marry those two realities. So when I started discovering composing and creating a home studio and like working, like getting commissioned to write for various organizations, and the kind of work that has flexibility where, you know, I can now drop the kids off at school and then come home and work on my projects and then put the kids to bed and then work on my projects some more in the evening, and I have that flexibility, and I'm doing music. That's something that I had never seen as an eventuality of something that I could ever be qualified for when I was younger, so that's why I didn't pursue it. But then discovering that it's not only something that I actually love even more than performing, I love the studio environment and I love composing, but it's also something that has a work-life balance that is actually a lot better than the office job that I worked at before. That's kind of where I ended up.
Is there an element of what people call compassion fatigue in the helping professions?
I think so. I think so. I think when folks come into it, they have so much goodwill and so much energy, and their heart is really full, and they're being enriched by being able to support various efforts, whether that's frontline stuff or whether it's working towards a cause if you're more a few steps removed from the actual front lines. And then I think for a lot of us, it just starts to wear you down, because you don't have that renewal and rejuvenation opportunity built into it. I mean, some places are better than others in that they, you know, are have those conversations about mental health and self-care, and there's, you know, a possibility to take time off. Towards the end, I was using things like needing to take an unpaid leave or taking a stress leave and those kinds of things, which luckily at the place where I worked, Interparas, they were very open and supportive of that, and a lot of places aren't. I was working in fundraising for those 7 years, and the average turnover, from what I've heard, of a fundraiser that gets hired in a fundraising position at a charity is about 18 months. Mm. So from someone coming in and being the fundraiser, on average, they'll last about a year and a half, and then they'll burn out, or they'll find something else, or they'll move on, or they'll change professions. Cause it's just, there's some stress. Not to say there's so many other jobs that have a lot of stress, right? Like a doctor or a nurse or a teacher, there's lots of stress in lots of other jobs too. I'm not saying it's the most stressful one out there, but it's hard to sustain for a long time. Mm-hmm. I found. Yeah.
So in your work, composing and also as a player, do you find that achieving a flow state is pretty easy for you, or does it come and go?
Yeah, I think the more frequently you are doing it, the more easy it is to get back to. It also helps to know where you are and what instrument you're at, where those flow states happen. Like for me, my happiest place to compose actually is at my wife's parents' house. They have a upright piano in a room that's just all wood, and it's just has a very live sound, and it's just a great piano. And for some reason, when you put the damper pedal on, it has this really beautiful, like, quiet tone, like you're playing lullabies, which is nice when there's like, if the family's full of, the house is full of family, and I could just sit there. I often do sit there for hours and write and come up with ideas and experiment and improvise. But it's at we have an upright piano here as well. And that's a pretty great place for me too. And when I have the house to myself and I'm there, I'm often, get into a pretty good state there as well too. Sometimes here in my studio, I have a MIDI keyboard here. Sometimes it can be pretty good here too. But I mean, often it's when I'm away from the instrument that I have the best ideas. And so I'll be thinking of a melodic idea or a rhythmic idea, and I'll record it as a voice memo on my phone to then come back to as my writing prompt when I'm actually at an instrument. But yeah, I feel like the more, it's kind of like a muscle. I feel like the more often you're using that composition muscle, which is very similar to the improvising muscle, it's just you're then coming back to it and developing it rather than like improvising it goes out into the ether and lives. But the more often you're using it, the more it's kind of always ready. Like I find that even when I'll be putting the kids to bed and it's silent in the room, and I just have like musical ideas kind of percolating in my head, and I'm thinking about them. Sometimes I'm sort of like tapping them out on my fingers. And if they're good, I'll say like, I'll be right back. And I'll go and I'll write them down, or I'll record them as a voice memo on something. I'm like, I want to remember that one, because, you know, they don't stick around forever, and I don't have a great short-term memory. So if I don't document it, then it'll be gone and the next one will come along. But yeah, so I'm grateful for that.
Wonderful. I was just thinking how much all this technology helps us creatively. Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's mind-blowing to think about the breadth of work that so many composers in history did, and their lifetimes were shorter too, right? Like they didn't have as many years as we have now. Granted, they didn't have as many distractions as we have now, but they also didn't have all the tools and supports where I can, you know, type in some notes and then hear back 16 parts in my software in minutes. And they certainly didn't have that. They had really great ears and really great imaginations and minds for conceptualizing, okay, this is what I've written down, and I, you know what those instruments will sound like, and this is, but it's so much more tedious, right? Like there's so much painstaking copying and then working with the players and then fine tuning, and it's, yeah, things are so much easier for us now to like all these memory aids and supports, and it's, yeah, I'm very, it's the best time in history to be a student of music, I think. You know, and especially with the access to music that we have too, right? I mean, there's debates about whether these streaming services are for the good of all musicians, but they do give us access to such a diverse breadth of music that a generation ago you would have had to have a very great record library or a friend who had a really great record library to even be able to access those. But now they're at your fingertips, and that's huge. That's really huge. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Jack, thanks so much for this today. It's been really fascinating and inspiring. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, my pleasure. Always great to talk to you, Leah. Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Thanks for following the series on your favorite podcast player and sharing your favorite episodes with your friends, all of which help find new listeners. I have lots more episodes coming in this season 3 with a fascinating diversity of musicians and their stories and music. Have a great week. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need my listeners' help. Please consider buying me a coffee. The link to my Ko-fi page is in the description. Every dollar helps me cover the costs of this huge project. Thanks so much.